Welcome to Steppin' Out, a reality radio show where you'll hear real people sharing their true stories of what it was like to go over the edge and find their way back. And now, Steppin' Out.
Welcome to Steppin' Out Radio, where every week you hear true stories of people that have triumphed over adversity in their lives. Very often, they have grappled with substance abuse, but have come out on the other side and are recovering. And we have a very, very exciting, funny guest who I'm really excited to have on because I know him. Well, I know his dad very well from the radio days. Anyway, he's a four-time daytime Emmy winner. He has a podcast called Fitzdog Radio, and it's on the charts on iTunes. He has a one-hour special on Amazon called Stage on Life. He has written a book that I urge everyone to get because it's got so much critical praise from NPR, Vanity Fair, and everybody in between. It's called Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons. And that's who we have on the air right now. Welcome to Steppin' Out. We have Greg Fitzsimmons. Greg, welcome.
What a nice intro. I mean, it was concise, but... you know, it made me feel like I've worked a lot harder in my life than I...
Had me laughing on the break when I said, gosh, you have all these things, I can't get them all in. And you're like, and I wonder why I'm sitting here. You know, because it's the life of a comedian, right?
There's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of sitting and thinking and wondering and worrying. And, you know, I'm 49 in Hollywood, and you sort of wait for somebody to knock on the door and just hand you a pink slip and say, you know, here's a ticket on the Greyhound, you got to leave now.
Right. It's just, yeah, it's hard. It's what's happened to people at work across the country, but certainly in your field. And being a comedian, to me, in interviewing everybody over all these years, I'd say to me, a comedian, especially a stand-up, would have to be so hard. But I don't know how you guys do it, but you do.
I think it's really hard when you're not funny.
Yeah.
You know, and there are guys that have been struggling at it for 20 years, and you just want to go, dude,
let it go.
Wrong occupation.
And it really must be hard if you aren't drinking, right? And that's what we're going to kind of talk about. But
yeah.
I imagine that would be hard. So usually on Steppin' Out, we begin at the beginning, and you have a, you know, fascinating story about your history with... you know, substances and drinking. And can you kind of begin at the beginning for us to paint the picture?
Well, yeah. I mean, you were a part of it. You were a part of my drinking problem.
I'm sorry.
You know, it was very, you know, I grew up in a Bronx Irish household, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, my father, well, I grew up in Tarrytown, but my parents were both, you know, Bronx Irish. And my father used to have this St. Patrick's Day party at the Friars Club that you used to come to.
Mm-hmm. And they were great, I have to say.
I think you get an insight into then what my childhood was, because my father was very gregarious, outgoing, life of the party, and my mom was right up there with him.
They are. Well, your dad, I'll say they were, but your mom. Yeah, they were great, you know, like you said, gregarious, fun.
Yeah, and they were bigger than life, and so, you know, there was a lot of drinking mm-hmm. around our lives. And from an early age, I can remember, you know, I started drinking probably at about 13 years old, and it was not something that was ever a big deal in the house. I'd get caught, and but, you know, my father was an alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I think from an early age, I felt like literally like the first time I drank a beer, I remember it was a Genesee cream ale that we found under the bleachers at the high school, and I had a swig of it, and my whole body just tingled and turned warm, and I just had this feeling like, oh, my God, this is going to be a big part of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And it became something that we just did a lot. You know, we smoked a lot of pot and drank as teenagers and through college, and it was something that really dominated my life in a big way.
But did you see, okay, because a lot of times on the show, like, people will say, but then again, everybody was doing that, you know, everybody was drinking in high school and drinking in college. Did you have a little inkling that maybe you did it differently or liked it more, per se, or, you know, did you ever have that feeling?
Well, I had a feeling that I was drinking when I was feeling emotions, which I knew was kind of a red flag. If I was depressed, I would drink. If I was celebrating, I would drink. If I was nervous, you know, it just became something that I was dealing with my emotions with. And, you know, and I was fun. I was the life of the party. I mean, you'd give me some beers, I'd stand up on a pool table and tell jokes. And, you know, I can remember coming home on Metro North from the city and being drunk and walking up and down the car and, like, making fun of people, but they'd be laughing and all my friends would be laughing. And, you know, it was, I was a good drunk, but then I would go too far and, you know, I was arrested a few times and there was some, there was a lot of, you know, problems with the law. There was, I got into a lot of fist fights.
Because you were making fun of people or just because then would you ever get like nasty or you were always,
no, I get nasty.
Always funny?
I have a short temper.
Okay.
And, you know, I would really react badly when somebody would diss me, but more often when they were being cruel to somebody else.
Okay.
Then I would just kind of jump in, like I had to like save everybody.
Uh huh. Wow, that's almost like a first. I haven't really heard that too many times. So
well, I was charged with assault with a deadly weapon freshman year of college because a woman in the dorm had been sexually assaulted. And we came back to the dorm, and we saw her in the hallway with her friends, and she was sobbing, and they told me what happened, and they said that the guy who did it was wearing a, it was the specific name of a town mm-hmm. on the sweatshirt.
Mm-hmm.
And so me and another guy ran out to try to find them, and he went one way, and I went the other, and as luck has it, I came across this guy with his friends, and they're football players, and they're huge.
Oh.
And I say, they want to talk to you back at the dorm. And the guy knocks me down, and then they take off. So I chased after them, and I picked up a bottle. It was a very fine fruit punch bottle.
Mm.
And as they were trying to get into the dorm, I had smashed the bottle, and I was holding them in the lobby of the dorm. They had to be buzzed in by the security guard, and I told them not to. And waited for the police to get there, and they were charged. And then I was charged with assault with a deadly weapon by them. They pressed charges on me.
Oh, God.
And so, long story short, the girl ended up dropping the charges against them because she didn't want to deal with it as a freshman in college.
Right.
And so they dropped the charges against me.
Oh, thank. Okay, that was good. But, God, you sound like... You sound like what people are telling people to do. Like, you know, if they see bullying, if you see something, do something. But I guess it wasn't good if you were holding them with, right, broken bottles and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, there's impulse control. And but I do really think people don't get punched in the face enough. You know, I think society was better when people would just say, hey, what are you doing, jackass? And punch you in the face and you'd be humiliated and you'd stop doing it. You wouldn't do it next time.
Exactly. That's very true. So what happened next? So, okay, so you had a couple of arrests, similar arrests, I guess, like, but you,
yeah,
got,
very
out of,
similar.
But you got out of them.
Yeah. So spent a few weekends in jail.
Wow. And did that, when that happened, did you ever look around and say this isn't normal?
Oh, I thought it wasn't normal from pretty early on. I mean, I really felt like, and I think I was hypersensitive because of my father's drinking, and I didn't want to be like that. And, you know, for all the great things about him, I think he was a sad person.
Right.
I think that he was burying a lot of stuff, and I didn't want to live. I wanted to live with more clarity than that. And so what really changed it for me was I had tried to quit a few times, and then I had started doing stand-up, and I'd been doing stand-up for about a year, and I had some success with it. Like, I'd found early on that I was pretty good at it, and I felt like this was the first thing I'd really been good at in my life. I was not a great student. I was a terrible athlete, and I just found stand-up, and I had loved it as a kid. I, you know, studied every comedy album, and I used to go to the clubs as a teenager in New York, and I just started doing it. And then one night, it was a show at Nick's Comedy Stop in Boston, and it was a fundraiser for the Boston Children's Hospital, and it was called Tits for Tots. And the idea was that all of the strippers from the Red Light District, which the comedy club was in, they would come over, and at noon they would do a show, and the place was packed with all these guys from Southie, you know, Sully and Fifty from the Carpenters Union, and they're all sitting out there, and they're drunk by 12:30, and the comedians would go up and tell jokes while the strippers would walk topless through the comedy club with hats and collect money. So it's an ideal comedy situation.
Right. The visual is great.
And I'm sitting there, and I got a buddy who's from Southie, and they're all drinking, and I'm drinking with them. You know, they're pouring me beers. I'm drinking the beers. And then it was my turn to go up, and I went up, and I stumbled through my jokes. Nothing was getting laughs. I knew a bunch of people there. I was utterly humiliated. And I felt like I'd felt at many times in my life before, which was that my drinking was getting in the way of things I wanted to accomplish in my life. And stand-up was this thing that I really felt like I had a lot invested in. I felt like this was one thing I wasn't going to throw away. And that was it. That was the last drink I ever had.
Are you kidding? Just 20, like that?
25 years ago.
Wow. So, okay, so give us... what happened next? So you woke up that morning and you were humiliated and you felt, did you go to a 12-step meeting? Were you just able to put it down by yourself? Did you call anybody? Did you like how did you do it?
Well, I'd been exposed to Al-Anon for the couple of years before that. I'd been going because of issues I was feeling towards my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so the steps meant something to me. You know, I got it. I got the process and the higher power and the, you know, giving over. And I go to these 12-step Al-Anon meetings in Brookline, and I realized that it didn't matter who was in there. It was, you know, there'd be the overweight woman with the sweater that she'd knitted who has 9 cats, and she'd be talking about her dad's alcoholism. And then this, you know, a black guy who's in there and he's tough, and but everybody's relating, and I would cry at meetings. I was very emotional.
Wow.
And I went to therapy, talk therapy, and I think it was all reinforced by the comedy then going better and better, made me feel like I'd made a strong choice. And it was really hard. I lost some friends that didn't feel comfortable being around me not drinking, and I felt uncomfortable around some of them. And then a lot of the friends stayed with me.
And how old were you at this point?
24.
Oh, wow. So, you have long-term sobriety. That's fantastic.
Right.
So you had to leave some of your friends, and then, so did you go between Al-Anon and alcoholics meetings, or?
Yeah. I mean, I mostly did Al-Anon. I did some, the trouble with AA to me, and it's a great program I recommend for anybody that's struggling with alcoholism, but for me, I didn't connect because I felt like, especially being in Boston, mm-hmm. you know, guys would get up there and they'd be like, so I'm holding up a guy in the alley to get a salami sandwich because I'm so drunk. And I was just like, you know, that's just not me. I didn't have this deep bottom.
Right.
I stopped before things got really bad. And so I felt more comfortable in Al-Anon where people were talking more about their feelings.
Right.
And, you know, I'm just more comfortable with that.
Now, did you go to adult children? Because just for the listeners
yep.
out there, there's Al-Anon, which is anybody can go, friends and family.
Right.
But then there's a specific that we've had people on the show from, you know, adult children of alcoholics. Did you do that or you went
I especially like the ACOA meetings, but I would go to Al-Anon. You know, it depended on the meeting. Hey, 12-step programs are interesting because there's some groups that are very rigid, and if you go to Al-Anon and you start talking about your own substance abuse, they'll go, wrong meeting!
More rules. No, but it's true. Okay, yeah, no, right. I can picture
and
it, yeah.
So some Al-Anon meetings and ACO meetings would kind of spill off into each other, and it was a lot of the same people.
Right.
It was a very powerful thing. As a matter of fact, I have a friend that's been going a lot in Boston, and here in L.A., I mean, and I think I need to go get a little tune-up.
I was going
to
say, do you still go?
I read the literature
uh-huh.
constantly, always have.
Okay.
The Ann Beatty book is very helpful.
Right.
And, you know, and I got therapy tomorrow.
Good. Now, take us to the first time that you had to do stand-up and all these new things sober. Was that very painful, or you were able to just miraculously handle it?
No, because I had not normally drank while on stage. That was
okay.
That was an aberration that I did it at the Tits for Tots show.
Sorry, every time
I was doing it for the kids.
Uh-huh, okay.
And so, no, I didn't normally do that. But it also affects, you know, you get up groggy, you're not writing your material, you're not going after work, you're, you know, I think drinking, if you have an issue with it, can really lower your self-esteem, and
right.
I think that it had an overall change in my energy. I think it made me more focused, and I think I took it more seriously.
Right, and what people say all the time, too, is drinking alcohol is a depressant, so very often you're depressed because...
Right.
You know,
right.
You're hungover, or you, why did I do that kind of thing? And so then take us to what, like, you had to get rid of some friends, but was it hard going forward? You know, can you offer some hope to people out there? I mean, you were 24. Oh, my God. You know, how hard was it? Or what, you know, what would you recommend?
Well, I think it's, you have to separate your, you know, there's the whole one day at a time thing, which you hear so often. But if you can find meaning in that and realize that, yeah, there's going to be a wedding where your friends are going to be drinking and you're going to want to. But there's a lot of people that use that as an excuse not to stop. It's like, I don't want to never have a drink again.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't and, you know, and realize that, yeah, you're going to lose some friends. But that's there's the price you'll pay. It's going to be awkward with your family. It was tough when I quit. It was difficult because, you know, my father was still drinking, and he reacted by telling me I should start drinking again. So you'll
you're
go up again.
You're not fun anymore or something, right?
Right.
Right.
Well, just he said you need to relax. You need to be able to relax and unwind, and that's what drinking will do for you.
Right.
And so you'll meet resistance, but it's really important that you replace the drinking with other things. Like for me, stand-up really became... It happened at night, so it was, you know, a very euphoric, focused, fun thing. You're laughing at other comedians. You're engaging in a community of people. Yeah, there's drinking involved. You know, the audience is drinking, and a lot of the other comics are, but there's so much life going on around it that I think it replaced the drinking life that I had at night. But whether or not you need to exercise in place of it or take up a hobby or, you know, use that time you would have wasted on drinking and realize you would have spent a lot of money.
Oh,
so spend that money on something else.
You're listening to Steppin' Out, where every week you hear true stories of people that have overcome adversity, and somebody who has certainly overcome adversity at a very young age and should offer hope, especially to the young people out there or anybody out there, because we all use excuses and say, well, you know, we're in our 20s. That's what you do when you're in your 20s. And Greg Fitzsimmons, comedian Greg Fitzsimmons, is a perfect example that you don't have to wait till you're older and you don't have to make excuses. But before we left the break, I wanted to talk about your book that received critical praise from NPR, Vanity Fair, and tons of readers. And it's called Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a lot about my relationship with my father, even
mm-hmm.
though it's Dear Mrs. Fitzsimmons. It's based on the letters that my mother saved over my entire life from literally nursery school through college. And I found them in my aunt's basement in the Bronx.
Uh-huh.
And it was like literally there was report cards from preschool where the teacher was saying that Greg seems to have some real lapse in his knowledge of the world. He doesn't know what a caboose is. He doesn't know how to wiggle. And my mother saved that. She saved every bad report card, every incidents card, every time I was suspended.
Mm-hmm.
There were clippings from the newspaper of times I'd been arrested. And it was all in this box, like some kind of a trophy case for Irish dysfunctional behavior.
Oh, that's hysterical.
And so the book explores why I was so rebellious and how it related to my relationship with my father as my first authority figure.
Mm-hmm. And how did it? How did all those letters relate? Because I bet you people out there can relate to, you know, you go to a Bruce Springsteen concert and so many of his songs are about, like, focus on the relationship with his father.
Right.
You know, it's a complicated one, I guess, especially when you're, you know, man to dad.
My dad was big, as you know. He was mm-hmm. big 6-foot-1 guy, and
he had a great voice, and he was larger than life. You're right, for sure.
Yeah, and he was a scary guy. He had a really bad temper,
mm-hmm.
and I built up this anger towards how I was treated, and I took it out on other people that were in charge of me. You know, the police, I would wise off to the police, and I would wise off to teachers and, you know, kids that were older than me, and anybody that I felt had, I still have an issue with people that have any power over me. And so that led to this perverse way of just acting out. And, you know, drinking was a part of that because I started at a very young age, and, you know, I was doing what I wasn't supposed to do at every turn, and it felt good. It was exhilarating, and it made me feel like it was my real identity. And over my life, my relationship to my dad changed, and I had some understandings about us, and I think it helped me become somebody who's more understanding of life and more peaceful. And, you know, having a wife and two kids now, I realize I'm a very different father than my dad was, but that I took a lot of great stuff from him as well.
There you go. See, that's, and what was your relationship like with your mom?
It was good. You know, my mom's side of the family is, they're just, you talked about, you met my Aunt Dolores, and
yes.
I really think my Aunt Dolores might be the, and I'm a comedian, she might be the funniest person I've ever met.
She's just lovely. I mean, beautiful, too. You know,
beautiful.
She's got both of that, you know.
Yeah, they're told. My mom's so hot.
Your mother is beautiful.
Oh,
beautiful.
What a
and
body.
And the way she dressed, and, you
oh
know,
my God,
and her personality.
Yeah.
You know, she had the great personality, you know.
Yeah, but their family was all about laughter. It's all about ball busting and, you know, teasing each other.
Right.
And just, you know, making fun of people. So it came from that. You were never allowed to take yourself seriously in my family, or they'd cut you right down, like, oh, who do you think you are?
Right. The opposite of what they do to kids now, like, you know, everyone's a winner.
Oh, I meet Jewish kids where their mothers told them they were the greatest thing in the world their whole lives, and I'm like, why couldn't I add a little bit of that?
Oh, that's, I think the same thing, because I came from the same kind of background as you, and, you know, I can remember, and, you know, not to put our parents down, but saying, like, I think there was actually a phrase, it's, you know, self-praise stinks or something, or, you know, or don't think you're, you know, who do you think you are? You know,
yep.
And like, you're right. I went to school with a lot of Jewish kids, and they didn't have that. And I grew up with more self-esteem. I definitely agree with that. So what's next in your life? I mean, I know you're doing all this writing, and tell us about, like, all the creative stuff that you do.
Well, just to put a tagline on what you just said, I married a Jew to mother my children.
There you go. And does she tell them how great they are?
Yeah, I think she does, but she's not, she doesn't sort of smother them with it. I think I might more, but I really think you can't tell your kids enough good stuff, because they're faced with so much, you know, so much of life is working against how they feel about themselves. I think that, you know, it's really important. I think there's a right way to do it.
Absolutely.
I think the right way to do it is to just, like my son yesterday told me that he's a really good soccer player, and he's a freshman at a really big high school in L.A., Santa Monica High School, and they've got an amazing soccer team. He's the only freshman on the varsity team.
That's pretty big, yeah.
So he told me, and I just said, you know what, you really earned that. How do you feel about it? You must feel good. And instead of saying, oh, my God, you're so great.
Right.
You know, sort of ask him how they feel.
And it's also authentic. I mean, you really mean it, too.
Right.
You know,
right.
You're not just saying, oh, everything you do is great, and the kid doesn't really, you know, necessarily even believe it.
Right.
So now your life, too, is you do a lot of writing. You do a lot of, do you still do lots of stand-up and lots of radio,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I just did, like, 4 weeks on the road in the last 6 weeks, which is a lot for me. You know, I just go away for the weekend, but it's great. I mean, the art of stand-up is always still exciting to me, and I always feel like I want to get better, and I have so much room to get better, and I want to write material that's more authentic, and, you know, and it's really just for me. I want to impress myself.
Right. You do it for you.
For me. And...
And so, now, do you work on any shows now? I know you used to work on Ellen and
yeah, I've written on, yeah, I've written for Louis C.K.
And Chelsea Handler, right?
Chelsea Handler, Wanda Sykes, Jamie Foxx,
wow.
Bill Maher. And so it's for me, writing for other comedians is great. I love writing in other people's voices. Mm-hmm. I love, you know, being around other writers all day is a blast. And it's nice to be off the road for stretches of time. So, you know, I go between writing and stand-up, and it's good because it lets me say no to jobs on either side.
Sure.
I don't have to write for a TV show I don't think is funny, and I don't have to go to, you know, Tallahassee, Florida.
Right. Ever. Now, speaking of Florida, I know it's the other coast, but how was the move? You know, you're a New Yorker. Was that a big change to go to L.A., a different...
Yeah, LA's soulless. It really, I've been here 15 years, and the roots that just don't go as deep.
Mm-hmm.
Family and my wife's from the Upper West Side, and mm-hmm. you know, all our family's back there, and we've got really great friends here in LA that we're close to, but it's not the same.
It's just very different, right?
Yeah.
Okay, before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask you, you still are doing, you know, the stand-up, and obviously you're 25 years sober, and congratulations, because, oh my gosh, there's
very few
people I talk to with all that. But is it ever still hard, or is it really behind you?
It's still hard, all the time. I was just in Lexington, Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, it's a big bourbon state, and they take a lot of pride in their bourbon, and everybody's drinking it, and I used to drink bourbon, and I was just looking at these, you know, this caramel-colored liquid in these small glasses and thinking, God, that would taste good, and that would feel good, and, you know, you just got to say no. Mm-hmm. You just got to get away from it, take your mind off it, and, you know, it's never easy. That ability to escape from reality in one gulp,
yeah,
it's very attractive when you're feeling stressed out and you're lonely on the road and
mm-hmm.
all that. But there's just, I know that I'm very, I think what helps me is I have a lot of gratitude for my relationship with my wife and the love of my kids and, you know, my career. And I just feel like I've built something, and a large part of building it was not drinking.
Sure.
And so it's
your kids, obviously,
dry.
And your wife, I don't know how young you were when you met your wife, but... they probably never even saw you drink, right?
No, she didn't.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, Greg, thank you so much. I really can't tell you how many people I'm sure you'll help, because we hear so many people that wait until they're in their 50s, and this is such a testament that you don't have to do that. And you can even do something as hard. And what most people fear most in life is to do stand-up comedy.
All right. All right, sounds good.
Okay, thanks.